Welcome to this episode of the Scaling Japan podcast. We're joined once again by Scott Schofield, CEO of Kovue. Kovue is a well-known brand operator in Japan, where they provide a full-service market entry platform into Japan, from import to logistics to retail to e-commerce. Kovue is a one-stop solution for foreign brands who wish to enter the Japanese market. And today, this will be our second part out of our two and potentially three-part series with Scott. And in part one, we've discussed e-commerce systems in Japan. And in part two, we're going to focus on logistics, compliance, and all the other things that happen after selling. So yeah, let's get started. Scott, could you please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Tyson. Appreciate it. Nice to be with you again. As you had mentioned, I am the CEO and founder of Kovue, and we do end-to-end market entry. And when we say that, it's not from a marketing aspect of it, but it is the true end-to-end, from licensing of a product, from import compliance all the way through to post-sale support, which would include field service, depot repairs, recalls, RMAs, and everything in between. But that's us. We've been around for about 10 years now, and seen a lot of changes in the industry. So great to talk with you about compliance, one of my favorite subjects.
And how many brands are you currently helping? I know it's a big number.
About 450 brands today.
So yes, I think first I wanted to dive into import compliance in the Japanese market. But could you help us understand about import regulations in Japan?
There's a lot to unpack on that. It's currently in its evolution process with the various agencies across Japan. It's interesting to see how they're rolling out. Some of them are not well planned. Some of them are very well planned. But import compliance, it's really based and in name on product safety and consumer safety, or end user safety, if you will. And then the aspect of tax compliance is the secondary founder behind compliance, at least the general rule for getting into this country. So they're looking for safety, and they're looking for tax. And I think nowadays, with the way the economy is and the current population situation, tax is a big one in the driver, and certainly has been from some of the new rules that have been implemented. In this country, you have, like all countries, there are only two really important categories. There's non-regulated and regulated. But how you come into the country, the flow in which you get in, is determined by that category. And it's an interesting thing. So a lot of people don't understand that if you're dealing with certain regulatory or regulated product lines like cosmetics, beauty care, quasi drugs, medical devices, those products actually require someone to handle the import, have be licensed to handle the import and the sales and marketing in the back end. And when you're registering your company or your products underneath that partner, you're actually relinquishing the control of your import rights to that company. So when you're choosing someone to do that, you really want to choose wisely. It is not always the best decision to go out and have your distributor handle it for you, because in life, like everything, relationships have their ups and downs, and sometimes they end. And that can be a very difficult process to unlist or delist your products that you've listed with your distributor if that relationship has gone south. So over the years, we've seen Japan start to enforce what they've had on the books for decades. They've had a lot of rules and regulations. Enforcement wasn't really a hot topic for them for a couple of reasons. It wasn't a hot topic because it was kind of a closed market for a very long period of time, and they didn't really need to. There was a dominant player. I will talk about e-commerce since a lot of people like to talk about that. The dominant player, Rakuten, is in the market space. It didn't really have any competition challenging it. All the kind of changed as Amazon, new marketplaces opened up to compete. And then the pandemic really opened the eyes of the various agencies on the holes that they've got with import. So there's this process that's happening today as we speak, where a series of rules and regulations are being rolled out to basically decimate the what we call cross-border delivery, which is fulfilling an order from outside of Japan to a consumer in Japan. For us, we call it personal import. That model is going to be pretty much decimated by 2028, and in the name of compliance, both tax and safety. And we see that today with all of the rules and regulations that are coming through. So when you're bringing something in, there's a journey. If you're a foreign seller, you need to understand that you're going to bring your products in if you're going to retain ownership for them. Whatever marketplace you're selling them on, whether it's your own web store or using a marketplace like an Amazon or a Rakuten, you are going to pay sales tax coming in. You're going to need a partner, more so than ever nowadays, to be your legal representative in this country. And that comes from either attorney customs procedure aspect of it or an importer of record, or in some cases, both. And you're going to prepay sales tax when you're coming in. There may be tariff taxes as well. And then from that point, depending on the product and what category it's in, it's either going to pick up from the port, clear its customs, come on through, have that representative processing all of this for you, and then moving on to its fulfillment center, wherever that may be. Or if it's got a regulation behind it, like a quasi-drug or a supplement or beauty care, it's got to stop off at the licensed facility of that representative for you in Japan, where it's going to undergo more inspections, quality control inspections that are required. And from there, they move, after that's completed, it can move on to its final destination. So import compliance has traditionally kind of been this old school thing. And today we see that it's getting really, really tight. Even in consumer electronics, there are a lot of changes that are coming up where you'll see a mandatory representative for safety as an importer of record or as the ACP. For the foreign seller, it has to be mandated. That's all about safety on batteries and devices hurting people and so forth. And there's kind of been a relaxed aspect of that from a PSC regulation standpoint, but today they're getting
tired. What is PSC?
PSA, power electrical safety. So that if you ever look on the back of anything electronic, you'll notice that there's a little circle or a little diamond with the word with the letter PSA on it that is applicable to those products that are PSC regulated or have to fall under that form of compliance. So that's nearly anything that plugs into a wall. And if there's a lithium ion battery that's user accessible, that would also be falling under PSC, where you get some creative exemptions, which is kind of nice for foreign sellers, is in the in by selling your product with only a USB cable. If you sell it with a USB cable and it's not plugging into the wall and not providing the charger, you can usually skip around and not have to worry about PSC compliance.
Interesting.
I think you'll notice that, which is kind of nice because also from an environmental standpoint, right? Everyone's trying to not provide a charger, an additional charger with their product line to save money, but also in the name of protecting the environment. But it also helps from a compliance standpoint of not having to comply with certain regulations.
Interesting. Before we dive deeper, I want to ask one question. So I know a lot of changes are happening now and with the goals set for 2028, but what was kind of like the catalyst?
Well, the catalyst was certainly the pandemic exposed a lot of tax fraud in there. And what's interesting, so there was an interesting set of rule changes that came out October 1st of 2023, which really pushes foreign sellers into registering for a Japan tax number. And the reason they did that was not really from e-commerce sellers. It was really because of noodle shops and small businesses that were out there. If you think about how certain expenses can be reimbursed or can be reimbursed in our system here, you realize that the typical salary person is running out having lunch and they're getting a registered receipt from that shop or restaurant.
Yes.
And they're submitting that to their employer. The employer's getting the sales tax back from that. But what's interesting in the loophole was that any business under 10 million yen a year,
yes,
did not need to pay any sales tax. So they could keep it. It was extra profit for them. So really the government was taking a huge loss in the fact that they were giving back taxes that were never paid. This was a move to eliminate that. What it had was also a knock-on effect across e-commerce. And there were a lot of e-commerce sellers on the outside that were fulfilling cross-border that were, I don't want to say they're intentionally running tunnel companies, but they essentially were, and evading the tax aspect of it. So these new measures are all designed to level the playing field for the local seller and the foreign seller so that there's no advantage. There still is an advantage if you're a foreign seller selling here. But overall, from a tax compliance standpoint, that's all come to an end. And now even deeper and deeper into it, you'll see new rules coming up here in June or July. They'll release a new one where you'll need to have a representative director or a representative, company representative here, which is another service that we've had to add on to help our brands. And that's going to be rolled out sometime this year, but they're talking somewhere around beginning, end of second quarter or beginning of the third quarter.
So you could have a company, I guess, represent you, or you could have a representative director.
Yeah, you're right.
And for the representative director, that I think that typically has to be a resident of Japan, right?
Yeah, so it depends on how you're coming. If you're going to stay a foreign seller on the outside and you have no intention of coming in and setting up, which really I can't think of a reason financially why a company would do that. It makes no sense unless you're going to be up at, 5 billion yen or a year and you need to drive some expenses down, then you would do something like this. But if you're a foreign seller, staying outside is probably the smarter aspect of it. Having a company be your representative, from a compliance standpoint is the smart thing to do. It's the most affordable to do. It makes the best sense, I guess, if you're coming to market quickly. But you're right. A representative director would require you to be a legal resident. Our representative company would have to be a legal company here in Japan.
Well, thanks for clarifying that. And I'll pass it back to you. And before I pass it, I'll just say one thing for the listeners. I have checked CoView's website, and based on your industry, there's a PDF for it on the CoView website. So we're going to link to the CoView website, but I actually did check each one, and the process is different based on the product.
Yeah, we try to give people a good view of the journey required for the product category. So that info is out there. They're welcome to search it and read it. It's all available for them.
No, it's really good. Very useful, and I've saved all of them myself.
Thank you. Well, feel free to distribute them. So coming back to import, if we're going to kind of stay on the topic of e-commerce and a foreign seller, the new rules that are rolling out are getting tighter and tighter. We'll see a lot more involvement with consumer affairs. We've actually seen a lot of interesting enforcement of consumer affairs. Just recently, it started to tick up. But all of this has to do now is that, Japan never really had the tools. A little history on Japan, you might think of it a very technically advanced country. And in some areas, we are, right? However, from a government standpoint, they still use fax machines in some areas. I think they finally eliminated them officially last year or made a mandate to get out of them. But the tools to be able to monitor and enforce regulations were never there available to them. And today they have a lot of tools. And they implemented those tools about 2.5 years ago. They learned how to use them. And now they're starting to apply them and enforce the regulations that have always been on the books and adding some new ones as well for protection. But nonetheless, you have non-regulated and regulated products. Non-regulated, I find that is an interesting word because in Japan, there isn't really anything that's non-regulated. When you think about this journey in here, it's not just so simple anymore. A non-regulated product just means that you don't need a governing agency's approval to come into the country or pre-approvals before you come in and start selling. That's the only difference behind it. But in terms of import compliance as a foreign seller, you have a lot of regulation that you're going to go through. And that, like I mentioned, the first part of that journey is that you need to, starting this year, you're going to need a representative. You're going to need a company to do your ACP, which is the Attorney Customs Procedure, or the importer of record, depending on how it's coming in. And you're going to need to pay any tariff tax that's applied to the product. You will always have to pay your sales tax. And I think a lot of foreign sellers don't realize that. And when you're budgeting and you're thinking about, Japan market and coming into this market, we as all business owners in this country, we prepay our taxes every year. It's based on last year's sales plus a trajectory, and you apply them. There are no ways currently for foreign sellers to really comply with profit tax reporting. I'm sure that's coming in the next few years. And there's really no way, because of that, there is no real way for them to comply with import tax other than tariff. And to resolve that problem, they comply with only one aspect of it, and that is prepaying sales tax. So if your selling price is 5,000 yen and you're bringing in, 100 units, you will be paying 10% tax in advance at customs for those products as they move into the country.
Oh, wow.
So I think a lot of sellers don't realize this. Now, there are ways to not do that, but it involves you actually forming a company, getting a JCT number, or you can apply for a JCT number, but then applying for a representative to take care of, take responsibility for your tax payments and your filings. It's right now, I would say, stay away from it because they're just rolling this process out and it's really messy. And any tax support that you're going to get is going to be from a foreign company like Pricewaterhouse or something like that. And they will charge you an extreme premium to foreigners on this. And it's usually just not worth it. So
what kind of premium?
I
think you said
a premium on fees. So if you know, I mean, if you're using a local CPA or accounting firm, the prices are a third what you're getting charged as a foreign person, a foreign company trying to interface with an English speaking accounting firm in Japan. You're going to pay for that and you're going to pay dearly for it. So I would say right now at this time, follow just the rule and prepay your sales tax. You're going to have to do that anyway, even if you formed a company here. So there's no strategic advantage of getting away with it. You're just deferring the inevitable, which is prepayment of sales tax at some point. When you form a company here, you're going to go back to complying with import tax. You're going to go back to complying with profit tax. And like I said, if you don't have a real way to expense your products out, your business, there's no point in doing it. So be prepared that sales tax will be paid on entry. And the good news is you're not paying the profit tax.
Hello, listeners. I'm excited to announce my live cohort course to help you increase your sales in Japan. Many foreigners struggle to turn first meetings into second meetings because they lack a sales pamphlet that follows the standard format in Japan. Even if you have a good first meeting, your internal contact will hand over your current sales pamphlet to the decision maker, and they'll take one look and say, they don't get Japan. My live 4-session cohort course will teach you how to make a sales pamphlet in English using the standard format in Japan. You will receive a sales pamphlet template, more than 10 examples from Japanese companies, and a lot of feedback, so you can end the course with a sales pamphlet that gets more meetings and therefore more sales. Getting one extra deal will more than pay off the course, so joining is a no-brainer. You can find more details of the course at scalingyourcompany.com/sales-pamphlet, and we'll have a link in the show notes. So I think a lot of the things that you've mentioned too, I've been aware that some products from overseas, they like to do a crowdfunding campaign in Japan on like Makuake or Campfire. Probably unlikely they'll use one of the other platforms, but those are the two biggest ones. And so I think this will have a pretty big implication on them too as well, right?
Yeah, it's going to have an implication. How that rolls out, probably we won't really know for another maybe 9 months or so. But rest assured, it's already probably putting some ripples into the process. I don't think Japan's really focused on that part yet. They're more focused on the standard transactions. You got to remember all of these rules, even though they're starting to roll out in enforcement, they're coming in phases. So they focused on non-regulated products first, the lion's share of transactions. And now they're going, now that that's rolled out, which came in fourth quarter of last year, over the next year or two, we will start seeing the rollout into the categories like food and quasi-drugs and pharmaceuticals and everything else you can think of. Right now, they're trying to juggle to figure it out. We watched when the initial rollout was coming on October 1st, they were going to include beauty products, personal care. And we challenged that because they couldn't answer any questions. And I'm referring to MHLW, which is the governing body behind those, by the way, for listeners, the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. Because they couldn't answer the questions, they actually, on the 2 days before the rollout, actually retracted beauty care products because of our challenges. But rest assured, it's coming. They've come up with a patch of it right now, which requires an ACP and an importer of record. And they'll continue to do it with the rest of them. But enforcement's coming hard.
That was very interesting. And thanks for also explaining in detail. From my end, I'm someone who I've passed the 10 million threshold. And so this is actually my last year, but I was going to extend it. So for me, like when they changed, it was like, no, I was hoping to keep this money until 2026. Rightly so, I've been pretty upset about it. Now, I think you mentioned this. This actually provided an angle that I didn't consider. It's still painful, but it makes more sense now.
Yeah, it was inevitable anyway. All they're doing is just closing off the loopholes that people were leveraging deeply. If you think about it, if you're a successful seller, if your business plan or your business model includes is reliant on you avoiding tax, that's probably not the best business model. Run your business model based on full compliance and then enjoy those perks and that extra margin when it's available to you, but don't base your whole business plan behind it. And I think a lot of very early sellers make that mistake, is they run their business for a couple of years thinking, oh, this is great, but they hit that marker like you. And all of a sudden, it's a different business model for them. And they're starting to retract and figure out, you know, how to improve margin, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've already prepared from the beginning of, I've this whole year, but my way of preparing for it is in my internal numbers. It's what is our profit revenue excluding sales tax? What is our profit excluding sales tax? So previously, I included it in my profit because I could take it. But yeah, I've had to change my financial simulations and let's say how I calculate things on my spreadsheet. But thanks for reducing the pain a little bit.
You know, if you want me to dive into, like, we could talk about a journey of a specific category if you'd like.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. And I had one question before I do that. If you could tell us maybe a little bit about tariffs.
Sure. You can easily go, and for listeners in English, you can go to Japan Customs and look up the tariff schedule. It is updated regularly, I would say every quarter. So you can go to it. It is in English. A tariff tax is related to a country of origin, a trade agreement or a sanction or a response to something. And so it's good that you always check your tariff tax if your product has a tariff behind it. Just because you're a brand operating in, let's say, America or Germany or someplace else, but you're sourcing from another country, that's where the tariff is applicable, is coming out of that country. So always, always, always check your tariff taxes before you start. As a process of you should have a nice checklist for coming into Japan. And number one is going to be check your product tariff tax implication. Make sure you check your compliance, import compliance, and even post-sale compliance requirements before you start, and ensure that your products can actually enter the country. But so that's what a tariff is. It's related to trade agreements or politics or a specific product or something like that. Always check them. And a good example would be like, if you have mattresses coming from China, they have a different tariff tax than, let's say, mattresses coming out of India. And so you see, more mattresses nowadays come in from India rather than coming in from China, just to keep the lower tariff tax. But they're applicable everywhere. And you can also eliminate, in some cases, a tariff tax. And you can do that by getting a certificate of origin, which we're licensed to produce those for our brands. But an example of that would be, we had a seller in Spain for supplements. Their product, was coming from Spain, but the actual manufacturing and production and everything was conducted in the Americas, down in Central or South America. And in doing so, we could get a certificate of origin that the product was actually sourced and produced in that local region. Although the final product was sitting in Spain, they were able to eliminate a 13% tariff tax on the product because of that certificate of origin. So please, on your checklist, foreign sellers, think about your tariff tax subjects and also your import compliance.
Interesting. And yes, I think we could go into a category now.
Sure. So we can talk about two good examples, and this can also be somewhat applicable to non-regulated, but two good examples would be like food, which is also includes supplements. And then we could talk about like beauty, because that's a huge category in this country. And there are a lot of brands selling. It's a very crowded space. So the journey for a food or a food supplement, it's a product that's not been classified as a quasi drug or a over-the-counter drug, is pretty straightforward. You are going to pick your importer of record or your ACP handler, a company like us or some other. Always, I would say, don't defer this to if you're using distributors, don't defer it to your distributor. Own your own import compliance for a lot of reasons. But The first process of that is that you are going to list a lot of information out. One is, where's the manufacturer, the actual manufacturing plant? Because your application is not about your brand or your brand name or your company. It is about the manufacturing plant that is producing that in the application. So you're going to need to provide that. You are also going to need to provide the ingredient list in detail by percentage. A lot of sellers will come in and throw these basic ingredients out like they do on the compliance label, like without the percentages, and they think they can get away with it. It's not possible. Every product has to have an ingredient list by percentage. And then the other one that's kind of a stickler, I think, for some sellers is the manufacturing flow process, which is absolutely required. So in a sense, you've now given the government the exact recipe on how you make your product. And sometimes that doesn't sit well with sellers, but it's required. And then before that application is made, that ingredient list needs to be checked. So we go through a standard process. Our compliance team will go through and make sure that every product is okay to enter. There are products that there are ingredients actually that are, you know, acceptable for coming into this country under one category, but as a food, they may not be. And they're generally used as a food everywhere else. So checking the ingredient list, checking and confirming that they're all approved in their quantities is so important. We see a lot of products, you know, rejected because of that. And so you're going to provide it, it'll be done. The next part to that is you're going to respond to some lab testing. A lot of times the government will ask for lab testing. In the past, they were pretty stickler about it in terms of doing it at customs at MHLW, which is very, very expensive. Today, they will accept lab testing in general from a testing lab in your local country or wherever it is, or even in some cases, self-declared from your own lab testing within your company if you're the manufacturing plant. They
That's a huge change.
Yeah, but they still reserve the right to pull the product aside. Even if you provide the lab testing, they reserve the right at any time on entry to pull the product and test it against those, compare those test results. One thing I would say to anyone who's looking to shortcut it, don't shortcut it. Actually get a real lab test and produce it. And there's no point in doing lab testing in advance of the application process because, you know, about 60% of the time, what you thought they were going to ask for is different. And so it's always better to just wait, let the application process roll out. For food or supplements, it takes about 60 days for the first approval. And then wait for that demand on the lab testing, then perform it or choose to have it done while it comes into customs. Once it's approved, so you never ship until you receive approval from MHLW. Once approved, you will ship it. A part of that journey, though, includes you're going to need a food label, a compliance side of a food label. So we have to produce that for you. And that's just localization for compliance from a food label. So pick up any food product. You look on the back of the boring stuff where you like to read your calories and what's it made of and what nutritional piece is in it. That is the compliance part of the label. So every food product's going to have that on there. And now you can come in. You're going to pay your taxes, your sales tax on entry. You may or may not be pulled aside for your first shipment and be tested. You will have to pay for those tests, by the way, or just reject your shipment and recall it. But usually you have to be prepared for that. There are expenses behind it. The government has the right to hold it up. It'll have to sit in bonded warehouse and perform some testing. If we found some interesting things, if it's maybe an ingredient or a core ingredient that Japan is having some issues with abroad on certain countries, you might find them to actually tie that up for a very long period of time, up to a month. They don't always do that, but we have seen it happen. It had nothing to do with the product itself. It had to do with country of origin. But nonetheless, you have to be prepared that there is a possibility that this is going to happen. So transparency and being prepared for the application is really, really important. And I would say that, you know, some things you have to consider, that there are times in that application process where you'll need to provide the manufacturing process and origin for a core ingredient. A great example of that are products that come from other countries that are using powdered milk. In Japan, as you well know, we've had some milk scares in this country. They're very strict about milk and milk products. So the source of where that powdered milk came from, the manufacturer, all of the same information that you're providing for your core product, your finished product, you may have to do that for some of your ingredients as well. So that's why, you know, making sure you double check all of the product ingredients before you start an application is really important.
In the case for the sales tax, so let's say you prepay the sales tax, what happens if you don't sell the product?
So the current process, you can do this. You can recall the product and ship it out. And we've done that for some brands. But to be honest with you, the cost behind that and the timeline, unless it's a large amount of product, and I'm talking about from a value standpoint, I wouldn't waste my time on it if it was $2,000. I'm going to, for foreign listeners, we'll say dollars, I guess, would be the easiest one. US dollars, I wouldn't waste my time on $20,000 worth of product line on recalling to get that tax reclaimed out.
Yeah, just to get that 10%.
It's really expensive.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Scaling Japan. In addition to serving as your fine host, I also provide advisory and coaching services to business owners who want to 2x, 5x, and even 10x their business. So stop holding your company and your team and your employees back, and let me help you and your company scale. Find more information at scalingyourcompany.com. Now back to the episode.
So beauty products are regulated like drugs. So think of them no less than that. And they're managed by MHLW, Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. With beauty products, again, there's an interesting journey for that as well. And you're going to, I should back up on food products. One thing I want to add about the food product, when you're doing supplements in food, that application you're producing is produced for every shipment. It's not a general approval for the next one. It is required for every single shipment that you do. The difference is that once you've done the first one, it's very easy. It takes about 60 days to get approval on that one. But the second and the third shipments, the follow-up shipments of those product lines can be quickly assembled with all of the information. Again, it takes about 3 to 5 days for approval to ship. Coming into beauty products, it's a different form of compliance, and that is that you're using more than an ACP, you're using an importer of record, which there's a kind of a difference. The ACP is really all about tax representation and making sure there's a responsible party from a tax import standpoint. And then importer of record is really about regulated products and the compliance behind those and the requirements that are required to be not only enter the country, but to sell. So beauty products are different. You make an application. That application, I always suggest to a brand that if you've got 20 SKUs and you're only thinking about coming into the country with, you know, 5 right at the moment, register all 20. Well, at least from our standpoint, it doesn't cost. There's no difference in cost for the application. What is a cost is adding another product. You will always open up an application with the government, with MHLW, to get the next product in. So when you're going to make this journey, consider all of your products. And again, remember, this is by manufacturing plant. It is not by your brand. So if you've got 10 SKUs made in one plant and 15 SKUs made in another plant, 2 applications with the government. The INCI list, which is pretty much the standard nomenclature globally for cosmetic or beauty care ingredients, that is the format in which you must submit your ingredient list. And it's got to be in detail with the percentage by percentage. And again, same interesting rules apply. There are some ingredients that at a certain percentage rate are not permitted to be used and will be rejected. If it's lower, then it can come back in. So an ingredient check, at least from our standpoint, is mandatory for us to do it. So we're going to do it ahead of time and make sure that everything is approved in advance. You have compliance labeling, which is absolutely required. And on the back of that, you will have your importer of record, which would, if you're using us, it would be our name on it, down in the little tiny corner at the bottom. It will also contain your plant's name, where you source the product from. So I don't think a lot of sellers realize that, but it will disclose. You're the brand owner, but it will disclose where the product was made and who made it. So that's something to always consider. The approval process for beauty care products, from our standpoint, we take about 28 days to do it and do it right. Those labels have to all be created as well. I would recommend to sellers, foreign sellers, please don't be cheap and slap a black and white label on the back of your box. you know, localization really matters here, and creating a virtual footprint is really important to consumer sentiment and how they feel about you. If you take your time and integrate your compliance label into your packaging, that is probably the best way to come into the country. But if you're just doing a quick test market, yeah, the black and white label suffices for a short period of time. But there is a big difference. And we have documented evidence with our sellers that it can impact your sales up to 30% and how the consumer perceives the product. A black and white label says you're not here. And an integrated package means in the consumer's mind believes that you're actually, and you have a footprint here, even though you may not.
That actually makes sense. Like I have seen products where they had something like, you know, just like glued on, taped on. Then when I saw, I was like, what is this product?
It looks sloppy, and you see a lot of, you find a lot of that in the 100 yen shops, right? And so I guess the mindset is always you get what you pay for, but consumers like to know like to believe that you're actually here if they have a problem. And that's important also when you're making your business plan to come into this country, depending on how fast you're going to scale. You know, if you're a low-hanging fruit seller, probably Japan is not your market, because fast, quick sales don't really do well here. They might work for a couple of months, but they really don't sustain. And having a good plan and creating a good footprint, a virtual footprint, and thinking about the consumer, that's really important. Back to compliance side, that label is required, so we create it. Hopefully, you're integrating it into your packaging. If you need help, we do that as well. We have an entire marketing team and design teams that help our brands with those, as well as the localization of the front side of the box, which would be equally as important to do from a sales standpoint. Whatever you put in English or German or whatever really matters little to the consumer. If they can read in their language, it's much better to understand what the product is. And then that journey, an application submitted under the importer of record or the licensed company that's for importing. You need a company to be able to import. That's one license. And then there's a sales and marketing license. And that's allows that foreign seller to sell not only to consumers, but if they were to set up with distributors, those distributors don't need licenses either. So our license for sales and marketing actually umbrellas everyone.
And you told me like some companies, they actually tried to enter and they didn't have that right.
Correct. They might get a company that just has the import license and they completely forgot about the sales and marketing part of it. And then they're out looking for distributors who have the sales and marketing license. Well, that's a needle in a haystack. Not always, but it kind of limits your market. If you're going to expand to a lot of retail centers, having one central compliance company that has an umbrellaed license to umbrella everyone selling is a little bit better and faster for omnichannel. Coming back to the compliance side, once you're approved, that authorization or that approval is now in general for that product. The only time it has to change or you have to seek another approval is if you change manufacturing plants or you change ingredients. If as long as that product doesn't change, it's sourced from the same place, all the application data is the same, you can continue to import that product without having to make another application and seek approval every single time. So it's a little bit faster on when it's time to ship.
My next question, I think you've actually covered a lot of ways to ensure that you're compliant. So I guess another question would be, is there anything else regarding compliance or any strategies you have for ensuring compliance? The other question I had in mind is, whenever we talk to you, it's always, you always have a very fine-tuned process for things. My follow-up question would be, is kind of like the role of maybe technology and compliance management, and maybe things they might experience with you guys, or like, you know, what they might think is the standard, but maybe they don't have that technology here.
So I'll finish on the compliance side with beauty. Once that approval is done, you're going to ship it in. The only thing you have to realize that on a product like beauty, it must arrive into the licensed facility for the importer of record, where it's going to go through IQC, incoming quality inspections, and as a compliance requirement, and then it'll go on to its final destination. But coming back to your question, from a planning standpoint, I think it's really important that sellers take their time for a moment and really sit down and understand the entire journey process of coming into this country and take that into account for their business model before they start, you know, look before you leap, I guess is the best way to put it. Take your time, get your products checked, make sure everything is correct. Understand your tax compliance, understand your import compliance, and really understand it. We're happy to talk. It doesn't cost anything to talk to our teams. So if you're coming in and you have a lot of questions, we'll lay it out for you on how it's going to be from that standpoint. And then when you talk about, you know, technology and compliance, so there are, you know, there are requirements from a license holder that obviously we have to do in terms of reporting to the government and the various agencies and tracking products and stuff. So that's, you know, there hasn't been much change, and I don't see a lot of change right now in that area. It's been very slow to roll out. There has not been a major leap in being able to fast track import compliance. And the reason for that is probably the same reason why the ambiguity here is by design. And that is to kind of slow it down a little bit from a market standpoint. The main driver behind that is the major agencies that govern regulated products have no central database in their systems for you to access. So you are forced to go through a slower process of an application and a conversation with an actual physical human. We've spent a lot of years, 10 years now, at building our databases. One of the things that we're very keen on this year is deploying AI throughout the entire operations of the compliance. We'd love to be able to connect into the government, but they just aren't there yet in terms of having an ability to integrate. And I don't think they would, I almost don't think they would actually do it. I think that would open the market too fast for them, but we would be prepared to do it. But deploying AI for us is really strategic in terms of being able to process products faster, research ingredients a lot faster for ourselves. We've been saving that data for a very, very long time, and utilizing it in that way is important for us. Speed to market is the most important thing. And I think that kind of is counter to a lot of companies, especially in regulated products. They'll hire a consultant. And I find that the business model on the consultant is not always aligned with the brand, right? Kind of takes a little longer. For us, we look at it as speed to market. The faster you're in the market, the more successful you're going to be, and less time and money that you're spending on things like compliance. So for us, we're automating as fast as we can, but I don't see a lot of things in the industry really making a big leap that's going to change anything yet. I hope it does. I really hope the government makes some major transformations in for digital, and then starts to open up areas that we can start going faster with ingredients and searches and product applications and submissions. There are some ways to digitally submit, but by and large, that backbone, the part that's really heavy work, it really comes down to how many cases that you've done and how much data you've been storing over the years to be able to go quickly.
Oh, no, this has been excellent. I think it's great that you showed a lot of examples where companies can go wrong and not end up wasting a lot of money, time, because I know some companies have, you know, they've wasted like years sometimes.
Yeah, they do. You spend a lot of time and a lot of effort. For sellers, you know, don't just focus on compliance, but really think about your marketing plan and understand that Japan has got a lot of products. It's got a lot of competition in the market space, and set yourself apart. Be ready to spend money to advertise. Without it, there's no low-hanging fruit. It really isn't. There are some one-off cases, but in all honesty, if you're not prepared for the entire journey in here, it's going to be very, very difficult for a foreign seller. You were asking if there was an example of anything that would be interesting. And I can't disclose the name because we have NDAs with all of our brands, but there is a brand that was a consumer medical device, which is an interesting product that was coming in. And the main device was manufactured in one country. And what we would call the consumable portion of that product was manufactured in a different country. And during the application process, the brand that manufactured, the OEM, was surprised to learn that on their compliance labeling, that source plant of their device and their consumable would be disclosed as the manufacturer, not their brand. And that was very concerning to them because they had IP and a patent within the device itself. They didn't want people to know where it was at. And so we had to come up with a creative solution on how to do that. And what it boiled down to, now this is not applicable to every class of medical device, because once you get into class 2 or 3 or higher, this isn't possible, but we could look at the manufacturing flow process of that product, that device, and we worked with PMDA, which is the equivalent of US FDA or EU, and we discussed with them in that flow process of what we would propose to do to finish the product here. And instead of having an importer of record, we became the registered licensed manufacturer of the product. And we finished it in our plants here in Japan, which protect the source from both products, both pieces of the product, the device itself and the consumables. It also, by the way, fast-tracked the company to get in. We had them in 14 days in terms of approval standpoint, because it was now being manufactured in Japan or finished in Japan, which protected the, and it also did what they asked, and that was protect the source plant in the end. So kind of a win-win for everyone on that one. But we get into a lot of creative aspects of that, everything from manufacturing, extending our licenses over small SME plants that maybe would have never worked with a foreign company in their lives, and taking over and manufacturing products under our licenses. We don't go out and build our own plants. It doesn't make financial sense when you've got some great companies out here. But the problem is that a foreign seller would never, ever be able to talk to these.
Yeah, definitely not.
So doing creative stuff like that is an interesting example, solving some problems.
Cool. Thank you very much for today, Scott. We'll put in the notes how people can connect with you and also to CoView's website as well.
That was great
Thank
to talk
you so
with.
Much.
Yeah. Take care.